50,000 feet. And I think you'll find, particularly the questioner about how do we bring this to ground and connect the dots, I think that you'll find that the subsequent presentations are going to help us make that upwards and downwards connection. So as I said, I think the way we're going to work this is Alan Brown, who's a principal of Wolf Brown, who's done a lot of really extraordinary research and other kinds of work on audience engagement, is going to be the lead presenter for this, and he will be joined for part of his presentation by Tom Caden from the Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance, which is doing some really interesting work with Alan on developing an index of cultural engagement and other aspects of how to engender broader cultural engagement in the Philadelphia area. And John McGurk, who is supporting a lot of this work, is also going to chime in. And they're going to present for about an hour. We're going to break it as on schedule for lunch at 1. There will be box lunches. We can, people can sit at the tables in the back, or I think you can go outside if you want, but we would then like to reconvene at 1:30, which we can do over lunch or however we want to do that, for the question and answer section related to this session, and then we will be on track. So without further ado, I'm going to hand it off to Alan.
Thank you. Check. Thank you, Marion, and thank you, John, for the wonderful invitation to join you all here today at this wonderful, wonderful place in this wonderful state. And if your ears are popping, it's the cabin depressurizing from Bill Ivey's supersonic jet. And if you smell burning rubber, it's my go-kart pulling up to Bill's jet. I am truly inspired by that fantastic thinking about the cultural system and particularly the Bill of Rights and questions about how we demonstrate value, which are germane to everyone in the field, and what does it mean to have a vibrant cultural life? I think that's an absolutely essential question that we have to address and not let researchers like me define the answer. So I have a ton of material for you. I wanted to just share with you a bunch of stuff in hopes that some bells might go off. So I'm going to touch on 4 studies, only one of which is done, or actually 2. And so very briefly at the start, I'd like to give you a short overview of 2 assessment studies. One, a study of intrinsic impacts, and a second, actually an evaluation survey that's going on right now in Dallas for the Thriving Minds Initiative. Those are not participation studies. They are assessment or evaluation studies trying to get at impact in new ways. And then I'd like to devote the largest share of time to giving you the first preview of results from a brand new study commissioned by the James Irvine Foundation, which John McGurk will introduce when we get there, and then close by giving you a preview of a new study that is still in the oven that Tom Caden will explain a little about, called Cultural Engagement Index. We're just finishing up data collection for that. Then, as Marianne said, we'll break for lunch. So I have the unenviable position of following Bill Ivey and preceding lunch, so it better be good, huh? those of you who have heard me speak about this study, relax. I'm not going to speak about it now, but only to make you aware that it is out there. I'll just indulge a quick story. I was sitting in the office at the Wallace Foundation, and Kevin McCarthy was making an early presentation of Gifts of the Muse, a very forceful speaker, persuasive speaker, and sort of at the end, he was finished and it came time for questions, and we were sort of sitting around the table and lots of long faces. scratching heads. And I raised my hand and I said, isn't it ironic that after 10 years of emphasis on measurable outcomes, you're finally telling us that the real impact of the arts is intrinsic and can't be measured? And Ed Pauly looked at me very charitably and said, Alan, if you can describe something, you can measure it. If you can describe something, you can measure it. And it took me a long time to figure out what he meant. But what he meant was if you can articulate a phenomenon or a question, you can elicit data that would help you assess it. And that one comment emboldened me to suggest this study. Because university, you know, arts presenters do a great job of taking attendance and they do a great job of counting money at the box office. And that tends to become the proxy for outcomes. But of course we know that it's about something different than that. So we developed a couple of hypotheses. We had willing partners here, 14 university presenters. I'm sorry, I can't name them all now. But they funded this study on their own with no funder involvement, which they're very proud of. And it allowed us to be unencumbered by any agenda except their own. And we asked people about their readiness to receive the art while they were in their seats. They took a survey right before the show about how much context they have, if they normally go to this sort of thing, what's their anticipation level. And then they took home a survey about their intrinsic impacts, captivation, emotional resonance, intellectual stimulation, spiritual value, aesthetic growth, and social bonding, all the soft stuff. And we had to write survey questions that were fun to take that they could answer, and they answered it huge. We had a 74% response rate on the first part and a 66% response on the second part. That report can be downloaded from the website. Also, some of you, I didn't bring quite enough, but some of you have a resource guide to the whole MUP, Major University Presenter Study, where you can access those results. So I just want to let you know that that's out there. We stuck our finger in the hornet's nest of intrinsic impact and actually tried to design a protocol that would begin to address how people are changed by a single event. And it's very controversial. We've had some really negative reactions to the study from artists who fear putting numbers on what happens to people and who fear that the data will be misused and subrogate artistic vision. So it's very much a thinking in progress. I'd also like to give you a quick overview of some assessment work going on right now in Dallas. For the Thriving Minds Initiative, and Thriving Minds actually is a new name for the Dallas Arts Learning Initiative. They rebranded themselves just about a month or two ago. And those of you who don't know this program, it's big. It's a citywide intervention. Wallace Foundation has supported it at a very significant level, as have other foundations. It's a partnership with the city and the school district. And our research evaluation team, my partner in this is Denny Palmer-Wolf, have been charged with the formidable task of evaluating this citywide systemic intervention. There is no treatment group. It's everyone in Dallas. And so that is a particularly challenging assignment. There is this sort of relentless urge to measure outputs instead of outcomes. You know, they want to know how many teachers did you hire? You know, how many people did you serve? But that's not, you know, that's part of the story, but that's not the whole story. So it really took us a long time to figure out that we needed to basically come up with a whole new assessment rubric. So we revisited this notion of creative capital. Most people know that term from Florida or Putnam, in an economic sense, but we think of it in a human sense, in the capacity of an individual to express or imagine or invent. It's a value system. It's more like Bourdieu's social capital. Whoops, we're going on autopilot here. So we're kind of redefining and claiming this notion of creative capital as an outcome of, in this case, an arts education initiative, but you could think of it as an outcome of a whole community arts system, right? Or an individual arts program. So just without going into too much theory here, one could assess an individual's creative capital, and that individual might be a student, a parent, or an employee. We definitely want to assess a family's creative capital. And then finally, of course, a community's creative capital, and that I leave up to much, much smarter people at the Urban Institute and other places to really who are already doing such incredible work there. We decided to focus on the individual and family creative capital and make an impact hypothesis for this initiative, that the initiative will measurably increase families and students' creative capital and make a contribution to this larger community creative capital. So that's kind of the thinking behind that. And then we had to deconstruct creative capital at the individual level. What is it? How does it break down? And so these are the five domains of creative capital. We developed a line of questioning around each of these domains. And then for family creative capital, we also defined five domains, but only two of them that this initiative would actually move, actually change. So because, you know, within the same family, different children will have different creative capital. And so they're not perfectly synchronous. But we believe profoundly that this thing called family creative capital actually is a part of an individual's creative capital and a community. So we have just sent 10,000 surveys home through the Dallas Public Schools on a random basis, and we had a 20% return rate as of yesterday. They came in, and the report on this will be forthcoming in about February. This is a longitudinal study. This is a baseline data collect. They plan to repeat this every 2 years to see if this initiative increases cultural capital of Dallas students and families. I just wanted to share that with you. Okay. Now let's talk about two new participation studies. You know, I'm not a scholar nor a practitioner, neither, but trying to bridge the two is sort of how I spend my days, because my phone rings when cultural organizations, when ticket sales are down and they think they need to do a study. I love it when they say, you know, we need to do a study about the aging audience. I'm like, you know, you really don't. You just really need to read the last 10. And it's another subject for another conference about the inefficiencies in our knowledge diffusion system. but increasingly now I'm hearing from funders who sort of are looking for some guidance on how to be more effective. And how to serve their communities. And I am a great student and fan of Maria Rosario Jackson's work at the Urban Institute, and have really taken her work to heart in terms of conceptualizing and organizing my own thinking about this work. But, you know, the old saying, you can't win the game if you don't know the score. And we're claiming victory without really knowing the score. And we have a lot of work to do, I think, with measurement systems, because lack of a good measurement system, I'm convinced, is a root cause of low public support. It's that thin norm that Bill was talking about, the thinness, you know, is because we're not holding up a mirror to the public saying we are creative in these ways. And it is meaningful to people in these ways. And so we really, you know, these two efforts that you're going to hear about really are our efforts. And I want to situate these studies within the Urban Institute's taxonomy of tiers. And I don't know how many of you have seen this, but most of the studies I've done over the years really have been tier three, you know, occasional studies where we'll go into a city and do a survey to sort of paint a picture of cultural participation. I think the NEA over the years has done great, great work in this, you know, establishing baseline data. My favorite anecdote is, you know, in 97, after, you know, they would call people and say, did you go to the opera last year or did you go to classical music? And that's the participation rate. And for the first time, they actually asked, well, what did you go see? And I got my hands with, because I wrote four monographs for the NEA way back on the verbatims, you know. So what was the last classical music concert you saw? Showboat with Tom Bosley. The King and I. What was the last opera you saw? Phantom of the Opera, Phantom of the Opera, Phantom of the Opera. And I exaggerate quite a bit to make a point that the public definition of the art forms is evolving, very much so. And what classical music meant 10 or 20 years ago is really different than what it means now. And meanwhile, we have institutions defined around very, very specific definitions of art form in a culture that is completely, you know, that is changing and diffusing. So the Irvine Foundation study really is a tier three data source. It's a one-off. It's a very deep one-off study that paints a picture about a specific area of California that the foundation wanted to know about. What we're trying to do in Philadelphia is actually move now to a tier two indicator that is conceptualized as a longitudinal study that every 2 years we're going to take the pulse of the community and report and data. And we're actually incorporating, as you'll see in a few minutes, some tier one indicators in this study, which we're calling cultural engagement. So we're trying to move up the chain of indicators here to get to recurring, reliable indicators of cultural engagement. Okay, now I have to give you a little bit, a tiny bit of theory here, so please don't snooze. I found John Kreidler's thinking enormously helpful. A little known report from 2005, Creative Community Index, where John posited this pyramid of representing the cultural ecology. And, you know, Bill, as you were talking, I was thinking, wow, I wish we could work in each of your Bill of Rights into this, you know, into this tech, into this system somehow. And we're arguing, not arguing, but Josephine Ramirez and Jerry Yoshitomi, who were advisors to me on this study, were challenging this idea of a pyramid because it very much smells hierarchical and like you should be going up. And we don't believe that. We don't believe that the top of the pyramid is the presumed destination, but rather we embrace people wherever they are in the system, and we have to learn to value them for where they are. But nevertheless, the notion of cultural literacy as a foundation, participatory cultural practice as an expression of that, as a manifestation of that, and then ultimately professional consumption of professional goods and services as part of the system. And, you know, I present this to cultural groups and start seeing the blank stares, you know, because they see themselves, and then, you know, the hardest thing to do for cultural groups is to give them a sense of how they fit into this larger ecology. You know, why should they care? If you're a museum, why would you care what's hanging on the walls in people's homes, right? If you are an orchestra, why would you care what people are listening to in their cars, you know, or in their homes? Or if you're a dance company, why would you care that people are dancing socially at clubs and parties? You know, and just trying to help people get a handle on the larger ecology so that they can place themselves in it and begin to make more points of relevance and connection. Another framework that I used in both of these studies, the five modes of participation, this came out of some work I did in Connecticut, based on the participants' level of creative control over the activity. So total creative control is inventive, right? You're actually making something new. It's original work and idiosyncratic to the individual. Interpretive participation, you're adding your voice to a pre-existing work of art. You didn't create it, but you're adding to it. A lot of participatory work there. Interesting emerging form of engagement, curatorial, which is the act of sort of editing, selecting, organizing art to your own aesthetic satisfaction. So what would be some examples of this? Anyone? iPod, absolutely. Downloading music. You know, also designing an attractive living space. Increasingly, consumers have attractive, low-cost objects they can acquire at places like Target and IKEA and actually are making artistic expressions with those objects. Observational participation is the act of essentially receiving art that you choose, or at least consent. That's the ironic thing, that half of cultural participation people don't really even choose. They just get invited and go. You know, so it's actually very passive selection. And then ambient, my favorite form of participation, which is art that happens to you that you don't choose. Right. I usually at this point choose, you know, pick someone in the audience wearing a brightly colored something, but there's no one here wearing. Right. So we didn't study. Yeah, there's. Thank you, Catherine Fukushima. Thank you. You are decorating my life today. Right. And then we also want to look across disciplines and even across modes at some different ways that people engage, and we want to just be able to talk about them and characterize them. And you interview someone for 20 seconds and you know how important faith-based engagement is, and certainly heritage-based. We want to be able to talk about that. Family-based. I made sure for the Irvine study that we defined a vector around engaging who goes to purpose-built arts facilities and versus who uses other community settings. So those are the sort of the conceptual frameworks behind the Irvine study and mostly behind the Philadelphia study as well. So now I'm going to take you through the Irvine study, and I'm going to invite John McGurk to give you a little background on that.
Alan asked me to talk a little bit about why Irvine commissioned this work, what we were looking for, and how it's useful to us as grantmakers. The research study was goes up online. It went up yesterday online on our website, so irvine.org, if you want to download any portions of this. It was also shared with a group of our arts grantees earlier this week, and they had some strong reactions to it. And now we are sharing it with you, grantmakers, and we're hoping to hear your reactions to it as well today. So there are three pieces that came out of Alan's work. First is on your table in front of you, which is the executive briefing. It's a six-page handout. On page three, it defines Alan's modes and vectors of engagement. So if you didn't write down all the graphs that he just showed you, on page three, it has page four, it has the definitions of modes of engagement. We also have an executive summary on our website. It's 24 pages. It's much more detailed and gets into some of the nuances and findings of the study. And then we have the full report, which is 189 pages. And if you have a six-hour plane ride home like I do, I encourage you to print that one out for the plane. It gets very, very, very detailed. It's heavily research lingo involved. I'm not sure that people that don't have a marketing background will be able to swallow and digest the totality of it, which is why we try to do two of these shorter pieces for the arts field to use. All of those are available on the Irvine Foundation website, www.irvine.org. So to the genesis of the study, it was a concept of my predecessor, Marty Heinen-Cady, to commission some work in connection with our Arts Regional Initiative. Irvine Foundation has a mandate to support cultures in all areas of California, but we see in California that the arts are primarily concentrated in the major metropolitan areas and in the coastal communities. And in the inland and rural regions of our state, arts has a different definition, arts has a different way of being in those communities, and with our Arts Regional Initiative, we were seeking to build the capacity of arts organizations in those regions. And so we asked Alan to help us to look at these regions with rapid population growth, very, very diverse population growth, I should add, and look at not just arts and not just culture, but even more broadly, creativity, and how do people engage in creativity in their daily lives. The objectives of the study were to develop a clear engagement, a clear definition of cultural engagement, not just this narrow arts or culture, but creativity, to take stock of patterns of engagement in the two regions. The two regions were the Central Valley in California, as well as the Inland Empire. The Central Valley, if you're not familiar with California, is the non-coastal region that starts around Sacramento and goes the whole way down through Bakersfield, Kern County. It's primarily rural, agricultural, although there are some major cities developing, like Fresno, a 500,000 people in this area. And the second region is Inland Empire. It consists of Riverside and San Bernardino counties, the east of Los Angeles, one of the most rapidly growing areas in the U.S., one of the most culturally and ethnically diverse areas in the U.S., a population of 5 million people projected here by 2010. And what had been sort of a bedroom community of L.A. and now is an expanded region, almost the greater L.A., as it goes out into the desert as you're getting closer to Nevada. So first, to understand how people in these regions, the immigrants in those regions, are engaging with culture and arts, to better understand the settings in which people engage, whether it's a formal setting, whether it's home, whether it's a venue, whether it's a community setting, and to gain a sense of how Irvine might support culture more equitably and more effectively in these areas. In other words, the sector is underdeveloped. There's not a major museum, a major symphony, a major orchestra that we can just go and say, here's the money, go do your work, like we could in Los Angeles or San Diego or San Francisco. But how do we look at the systems that are less developed and support those in a way that makes a meaningful difference to the community and to the individuals there? So that's how Irvine came up with the concept, and then Alan has taken it and run with it. This was one of the first grants that I made at Irvine. And it was interesting, when I read Alan's proposal, I envisioned Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. Alan on this bus with gold lame and opera blaring out the windows, driving down the Central Valley, asking people how they engage in creativity.
I had actually proposed that. But not quite on the bus. Someday we'll do that. Another
study.
He's
come up with much more practical tools, thanks, like surveys and interviews. Yeah. So I'll let you take it from here.
All right. I'll get you back for that, John McGard. Thank you, John. So as John mentioned, the geographical purview. I mean, this is a huge area, folks. This is the population of Virginia or New Jersey. This is not a small area. There's a lot of people, and it's growing at an enormous pace, and there are very, very few nonprofits in this area. So this study presented some interesting methodological challenges. First of all, it was enormous geographically, and we also had to get to really diverse populations. So, of course, we started by interviewing cultural leaders in both areas and asking them, you know, what activities should we be asking about? You know, because, you know, any of you research, you predetermine the outcome of your study by what questions you ask. And particularly in this study, we had to really be in touch with which activities should we be asking about to capture the sort of diversity of engagement in all the art forms. So we set out and we interviewed. Then we did our first phase of data collection, which was really an incredible experience. We hired survey crews, all people of color, multilingual, to actually, we chose six neighborhoods, three in the Fresno area, three in the Riverside area. And we went knocking on doors, asking people about their creative and cultural activities. Hello, may I ask you some questions? You know, and we had our highest response rates in the lowest income neighborhoods. And in the most affluent neighborhood, we could not get people to answer their doors. It was very disheartening, and we wound up actually picking up some responses by mailing surveys. And I had just the most incredible interview in Riverside, which maybe I can share with you. But I have to go through this really, really quickly. So that was truly random. We had about 150 to 200 completes in each of the six neighborhoods. We complemented that with a huge online survey anyone could take. We promoted it through media, heavily by email. And then we sent survey crews to specific communities to get samples from specific populations, including Hmong community. We translated our survey into Hmong and had them orally administer it. We sent crews to Selma, a small farming community, and had a sample of Mexican farm workers. We sent people into both African American and Latino churches, sampled people there. Anyway, that gives you sort of a general sense of the sample. That's not random. We can't generalize about it, but we did weight the data to try to remove as much bias as we could. So we covered all of these disciplines, and you know, there's always some activities we want to ask about that are difficult to categorize, you know, like gardening, preparing traditional foods, certainly taking photographs, and because we wanted to kind of get some of that stuff too. I call that the living arts, you know, the arts of everyday life. And then just to give you an example of the questioning, we asked people, which of the following, for example, dance activities do you do regularly? All right, now you can drive a truck through that definition, do regularly, but we let people obviously self-define that. And these were the, you know, for each discipline, there were seven or eight categories of activities. And again, these protocols are in the back of the report if you want to read them. But we tried to cover from inventive to observational and include participatory forms of engagement and then also observational. So attend performances by dance companies. We did not distinguish between professional or amateur or school, you know, but just attend those, and we included praise dancing in church and so forth. And that's just to give you. Then we also said, where do you do your dance activities? And allowed multiple responses, listed 10 different settings. And then for some of these, you know, we dug a little deeper. So, okay, so you dance. What styles of dance do you dance? And a mountain of qualitative data, which we analyzed. To get the just incredible diversity of styles, not just dance, but also types of music that people listen to at concerts. And then follow one question for each discipline, because we wanted to try to get at latent demand. You know, it's like, what do you want to do more of, right? Because that's what we really need to know something about. So we just gave people the same list and said, which of these activities would you most like to do, if any? So that just gives you a sense of the architecture of the protocol, and I'm going to go very quickly through some key findings here. This is actually data from the on dance activities from the neighborhood surveys. The different colors represent the different neighborhoods. I don't have time to describe them now, except the red neighborhood was Fig Garden, which is the affluent neighborhood north of Fresno. So social dancing at nightclubs or parties was and learning dances from friends or family members really were the top two dance activities in terms of engagement. Now, in the door-to-door survey, we actually asked these questions in reference to anyone in the household, right? So it's a little different because we didn't want to just ask that person. We wanted to ask about their whole family. So you can see the huge differences by neighborhood for some of these activities, right? Go over to the right, and you'll see attending dance performances by, you know, by companies. You know, here we have the Fig Garden people now. at almost 30%. But look at those figures for social dancing and learning dances at in Selma, which is a rural farming community, predominantly Hispanic, and also Delman Heights, which is predominantly Hispanic, very low-income neighborhood outside of San Bernardino. All right, just to give you a flavor, this is music, you know, listening to the radio, the dominant form of music participation, at least of the categories we asked about. You know, so if you begin, you know, if you really want to do systemic intervention with music, you really need to be on the radio. I often get chased out of boardrooms at orchestras suggesting that they might merge with the radio station. Attending concerts is also a predominant activity. And then look at downloading, all right? And I have another data point on that. But, you know, huge differences. But you begin to see how downloading music, which is what form, what mode, curatorial, right, is rising. And then all the other music activities, we included as inventive, the far right, composing or arranging. You know, we didn't expect many people to say they do that. And in fact, we found anywhere from 5 to 15, 19% of people doing it. You know, love to know exactly if they're working on a computer, you know, using, what's that program that's pre-installed on every Macintosh? GarageBand. Thank you. Heritage-based, I mean, this really follows up what Bill was talking about, that the import, we wanted to try to understand the importance of heritage-based engagement here. So we asked people, do you participate in any community cultural events that celebrate your own heritage? And look at the figures. Look at the difference in figures by race, ethnicity, and our focus samples off to the right. Right, all the way, 80% of our sample of Mexican farm workers said yes. I participate in community cultural events. And you begin to see the important role that these events play in the cultural system in these communities. Okay, age by downloading. No big surprise. But at the youngest age cohort, downloading exceeds going to concerts. There's a fundamental paradigm shift in how people engage with music that's coming down the pike here just as sure as the Queen Mary. All right, and as many as more and more older adults learn to download and organize music, this is only going to go up, up, up. So I don't know quite how any music organization cannot deal with digital music distribution in this age. You know, I don't know why any orchestra or chamber music organization doesn't automatically send everyone music file of a piece they heard at the conference afterwards, or why any theater doesn't automatically email people an image of the play they just saw. I just don't quite get it. I fell out of my chair, reached for the oxygen tank when I saw this. On average, 33% of adults said they wanted to take dance lessons. In these, on average, in these two areas. Not dance socially, but take lessons. Acquire skills. Now, unfortunately, we didn't have that item on our survey, which we added for Philadelphia, which is, do you watch television shows about dance or dance competitions? You know, and I have seen this in other research, but this is the moment for dance in our country. There is a tidal wave of interest in participatory dancing driven by these television shows. And, you know, best I can see, the dance field doesn't know whether to shit or go blind. Pardon my French. You know, all they care about is will they come, you know, will they buy a ticket? And this is that value system we have to move beyond, because we have to start caring about people dancing as a valid outcome of cultural engagement, of cultural policy, really. So, you know, just consider, you know, what are the tactical implications of accommodating even a fraction of that demand? You know, where are they going to go to learn? And who's going to teach them? So it really is very provocative. Also, 20% of people said they want to do photography. 16% on average want to take music lessons. You know, there's a lot of interest in learning to do, to make, to get involved with personally. Right now, it seems, in the study very much. A bunch of questions in the study about role models and other kind of social aspects. And we asked this question, can you think of a person either living or dead who inspired you or helped you to express yourself creatively? I call a cultural role model. And you can see the results there. Only 24% said no, which is good. But only 12% said they had both in-family and out-of-family cultural role models. And non-family role models, right, was high, much highest for whites. And so just look, this is just a standardized Z-score, standardized variance graph. The red bar are the respondents who reported having both in-family and out-of-family role models. And their participation in inventive, interpretive, observational. And look at the variance. The yellow bars are people who had out of family only, and orange in family only, and gray, of course, none. All right, so all this does is point to sort of the one of the root causes of participation or engagement, rather, in this case, attendance, is modeling, behavior modeling. You know, and what can we do, what can you do as funders and as cultural providers to actually validate, recognize, and reward people who introduce others to cultural experiences, right? Because humans learn from humans. Setting. Lots of venues. And this is a graph of incidence of citing different settings by race. By racial ethnic cohort. Look at the red, the African-American figure for places of worship. All right, again, it's very intuitive, but it's three times what it is for other groups. And look at the white figure for using theater or concert facilities. Okay, we found three or four times higher incidence of citing use of purpose-built arts facilities among whites compared to Hispanics and African Americans. All right. Sorry? I'm sorry, I still didn't hear. Oh, yeah, the internet, yeah. Well, people aren't dancing on the internet, thankfully. That's one of the, well, they, you know, someday someone will design a Wii device where you can dance with Palabolas in your living room, and, you know, hopefully that's coming. and another setting, you know, the dominant venue for music participation is the home followed by the automobile. No big surprise there. But again, if you're a music organization, you know, being relevant to people in their homes and in their automobiles is really super important. You know, particularly all those people who spend 30 or 45 minutes in their car twice every day, you know, hungry to listen to something interesting. So a lot of takeaways about setting, and then this sort of big definitional thing, you know, people accuse us researchers of predetermining the outcomes of studies by defining the questions we ask. And of course we do. You know, you get the answers that you ask questions of. So if we only asked about visiting museums, that's the data we would get, right? But when we ask about quilting and stitchery, we get a whole different picture. And this is just an example of what can happen when you start asking about a broader range of activities. Is that it really paints a very different picture. Educational attainment, you know, this has been one of the central tenets of arts participation research for decades. You know, but look at the average education level of people who engage with live observational. It goes way, way up, and the point here is that people with more modest education levels are more likely to be engaged with inventive and interpretive activities, doing arts practice. So if you want to serve those populations, that's that's where to look. And then finally, you know, proving something that's very intuitive or obvious even is different people with different cultural backgrounds engage differently. All right, and so these are our vectors by racial, ethnic cohort, and the pink bar there is African Americans. Look at their variance on faith-based engagement, and similarly heritage-based engagement for all the non-white cohorts. And for whites, look at the variance on use of arts venues, and negative variance on heritage-based. All right, so it's very intuitive, but all it suggests is that, you know, that if we truly want to serve different communities, we have to look at different modes of engagement, different settings, and begin to actually reconstruct the whole system. So implications for funders. I'm sorry for putting so much text on one slide here. And I think we can come back to this when we have our discussion. I think maybe I'll just put this slide up so we can think about it over lunch. But, you know, it's really caused us to think, and this is profoundly challenging stuff, because we're very good at receiving well-written grant applications and judging them on artistic excellence and making grants. And really what this study suggests is, you know, what does excellence mean in a community context? And what is your framework? Do you have a framework for supporting culture? What part, where in that pyramid of Kreidler's ecology do you want to operate? Do you want to invest in the infrastructure that supports participatory culture? Or do you think it doesn't need to be supported? You know, there's certainly a valid philosophy that you only would support people at the professional level. But I think increasingly we're seeing that if we don't deal with cultural literacy and participatory culture, there ain't going to be no one floating to the top of the pyramid. So it is a huge audience development issue for cultural institutions. So lots of questions for funders that I hope you will react to, and really have a conversation with John when we come back after lunch. Okay, I'd like to transition now to the second participation study and give you a quick briefing on that. And to start that, I'm going to ask Tom Caden to join me and give you a little context on what he's up to.
Thank you all, and I think we were probably 10 or 15 minutes from lunch, so this is an even more dangerous slot to speak in. But, I will tell you, sort of to continue the airplane and height or altitude analogy, if we were at 50,000 feet earlier with Bill and with many of the researchers were here at 10,000 feet, I feel like at the Cultural Alliance we're sort of at the 5,000-foot level, which is we're sort of the appliers of research, and it was kind of fun for me to be here today because I feel like I'm sort of a little starstruck. I'm at the Academy of Awards for Cultural Marketing Research. I've got Bill Ivey and Alan Brown and Richard Evans and Maria Rosario Jackson. So this is kind of a great shopping event for me as a consumer of research. So I'm going to give you sort of the bias of the sort of consumer's perspective of research, or sort of the practitioner's perspective. And I think Alan asked me to essentially talk about two things, which is what's the cultural engagement index and why are we using it? So I'm going to talk about those two things. But I think I need to set a little bit of context, which is, first of all, I need to understand what the Cultural Alliance is. We essentially do three things. We do policy work around research, planning, and advocacy. We do umbrella marketing, and we do membership services, essentially the premise is that we should help folks collaborate. And I think, as we were talking earlier, increasingly scarce resources, collaborations are going to be inevitable. We as stewards of consolidated resources feel, I think, sort of even more responsibility now than at any point in our past. The mission of the Alliance is to increase awareness, increase participation, and increase support for arts and culture. So within that, under our marketing work, we've been working with the Pew Charitable Trust for the past 6 years on a program called Campaign for Culture. And we think we've done some pretty good work, and I'll talk more about that in a session I'm doing with Catherine on Monday. I won't dwell on it now, but just suffice to say we built a regional events calendar that's shared by 16 partners. We've created a weekly email blast called Fund Savers that has 70,000 subscribers. We've built a mailing list co-op that has about 1 million names in it and 100 organizations trading names with each other. So lots of good stuff, and we could sort of walk around and sort of pat ourselves on the back and say, good work, you know, we feel really good about this. But I think as we were coming into the, with about a year and a half left on this program, we went to our partners at the Pew Charitable Trust, and so we sort of said together with them, what's the next level? What do we need to do? Because there's 5 million people that live in the region, and you know, if 70,000 of them are getting our email blast, seems to me there's a few left that we haven't reached yet. Right? So what is it that takes us to the next level? What's the next big jump? And we tried to think big, and I think our grant cycle as a grant recipient has always been sort of 3 years. But what we tried to do with this was think longer term, which is if we got it right, what would the world look like in a year, and we picked 2020? If we did everything right, what might it look like? And that, I think, freed us up to think a little bigger about the work that we were doing. And so it was the genesis of a program, again, that I'll talk more about on Monday, called Engage 2020, of which the Cultural Engagement Index is a subset. So to try and get a handle on this, we talked to our members and we said, what would you want from the Cultural Alliance? What would help you sort of move things forward? And they said, research. And we thought, good, we like research too. So then we got on the train and we went up to visit our friends at the Wallace Foundation because they're always doing really good research. And we thought, oh, let's sort of find out what they're up to. Little did we know that not only would we come away with sort of the research that they were doing, and by the way, they gave us early galleys of Bill Ivey and Steve Tepper's Engaging Art book, which was absolutely instrumental in shaping our work. So, you know, thank you for that. But we also ended up coming back with them as another partner in this program. And so so Wallace, together with Pew, actually ended up working together to fund this work. And it's actually Wallace is underwriting the Cultural Engagement Index. So we went up for research and came back with research and money, which is always good. But anyway, we sort of set this... what we call a BHAG, to borrow Jim Collins' language. It's a big, hairy, audacious goal, which was to double cultural participation by the year 2020. And we thought if we set something sort of bold, it will push us to do good work. So we read the literature, we read Bill's book, and we knew, okay, what's going on in the field? There's definitely a migration, or there's a need for more participatory arts and culture. We know that people are active creatively, but it's not necessarily being captured in traditional forms of participation, so we need to get at that. We learned from Barry Schwartz's work in that book that people want, say they want choice, but in fact they're paralyzed by choice, and that what we really need are filters on that choice to enable people to sort of digest those things. So we sort of blended all that along with some intuition, and unlike most of the people that come to this field, I actually am not an artist who's sort of migrated into this. I actually come into it from a service organization standpoint. And when I was in business school, we learned about something called the 5 P's, right? This is sort of marketing 101, but it's product, price, place, promotion, positioning. And the thing that sort of astounded me as I came to this field was that the marketing folks in this field never, ever get to talk about product, right? That here we seem to sort of function in these silos where the development folks and the board are supposed to raise the money and the executive folks are supposed to sort of manage the organization. And then the marketing, the artistic folks come up with the product, and then somewhere along the line, the marketing people get the product, and they say, "Here, go fill the seats." Very, very late in the equation. And so, research for us, and this is sort of at the answer of why are you doing this? Research to us feels like the common language that brings all these groups back to the table to talk about what's the evolution of the product, and it's where we finally get to introduce product into the marketing equation. And we think until we do that, we're not really going to sort of break through. So, but if I ever say product in front of a group of our members, it's the third rail, right? So we're being very, very careful about the way we do this. But if you want to know what the heart is, it's fundamentally about product. Meanwhile, Alan had been working with us, or had proposed this Cultural Engagement Index 2 years earlier to us, and it sat on the shelf when I was sort of digesting it, which just goes to show that I'm not an early adopter, right? Sort of needed to sort of bubble up within. So that's sort of the premise that sort of led us to this point. But we, I got that sort of long-anticipated survey off the shelf and said, okay, Cultural Engagement Index, you know, what are we trying to do here? So, thank you. This one? Okay. All right, so the premise of it is, first, it's sort of modeled after the CPI, right? We all know, we hear the reports of the Consumer Price Index all the time. It's about inflation, right? It's really important that we understand the concept of inflation, but we have an index that helps us understand inflation. Now, the index doesn't encompass all of inflation. It's not every good that's in the economy. It's just an indicator. The premise of the CEI is the same thing. It's an indicator. We're never going to be able to encompass all of cultural participation, but we want to get at something that enables us to talk about it. Right, it should be built on a market basket of indicators, right? That isn't just attendance. All the traditional measures that we were traditionally evaluated about was just about butts and seats, and we realized that as we sort of read literature, engagement is about a lot more than just attendance, and we wanted to try and encompass that. Survey research. So there's sort of two key components of this. The first is survey research, and as you saw with Alan's work with Irvine Foundation, the breadth of participation is really important to capture in this. And it's really important to think about this from the consumer's perspective, right? We always sort of look at it as from a supply side standpoint. What we're trying to get at here is the demand side. Like, and the other issue is, in this sort of old expression, you don't know what you don't know. If we don't ask those questions, right, we don't know what the folks we're trying to reach are thinking, because we keep surveying the people that already come. So survey research of the broader population, very important. Secondary quantitative measures, and again, this is building on Maria Rosario Jackson's work that Alan alluded to earlier, but we think there's sort of a role for ongoing measures built into this that we can track over time that again, sort of broaden our perspective and our understanding of what's included in engagement. And finally, really important that it's longitudinal. So the index will be 100 in year one, right? But we at least have a year one. We haven't had it before. So it helps the alliance with measurability and credibility, enables us to prove it, which we're asked to do all the time. And again, as resources get more scarce, being able to prove it is going to count. All right. So what's the payoff, right? So we think there are going to be several things that come out of this. The first is the function of the you're already doing it component. Lots of folks are culturally active, but they don't know it. If we say, are you culturally active, they think sort of traditional art forms, and they think, oh, that's not for me. That's not what I do. We think one of the things that's really important about the construct of this is that it will raise people's awareness that they're already doing it, and sort of build the cool factor and decrease the sort of elitism myth that we have to bust all the time. So that's important. Alluded to this earlier, we think it's going to unite the artistic, executive, and marketing folks and get them around the table to talk about the experience and the product. Very important. Research. Oh, ah. My arrows didn't come out. That's okay. Flinch. Anyway, this is supposed to, the A, is that accent aigu or grave? I can't remember. One of you French scholars could tell me. Anyway, those are supposed to be arrows that basically show a migration from research to development to product innovation. Again, lots of other industries have a strong R&D function. This is essentially about our R&D function. So we want to go from research to development to product innovation. We need a PR success story, right? If we can report on the engagement index, we've got something that we can take to the media, and we're getting headlines, right? So there's a story. It's an advocacy tool. Again, we can take it to the government folks, funders, corporate folks, to make the case for arts and culture, because again, we can sort of put a label to it. It enables us to prove our ROI, which we're asked for frequently. It's a motivator for staff. Most people like to play for winners. Keeping score enables you to have those high five moments when you hit an objective. So again, we think counting and having those benchmarks will matter as a staff motivator. And finally, we're actually going to use it as a criteria for some innovation grants we're doing. The criteria that go into the Cultural Engagement Index will actually be used in the third and fourth year of this Engage 2020 program as criteria for grant applicants, so that the things that they're submitting actually line up with the things that we're going to be measuring. So we're hoping that will also help move the index. Thank you.
Great, Tom. And now I'm just going to blow through this really fast so we can get to lunch. This is really presents, as a researcher, a methodological challenge. As you know, random sample telephone work is very challenging now. And I have a little ethical problem asking people to do something that I won't, which is pick up the phone when, you know, some research firm calls. And so the cost, and, you know, there are extraordinary costs involved with achieving random samples by that method. So this is something we have to work on together, is figuring out cost-effective ways of doing random general population research. So the solution that we're using in Philadelphia is a combination of an online, commercial online panel. We bought completes from Market Tools, which is the company that developed Zoomerang, and they sold us about 1,000 or so completes. They have people who've signed up to take surveys all areas of the country. They get points that they can redeem for prizes. And we also got some online sample from SSI, which is Survey Sampling Inc., based in Connecticut. And I made the outrageous promise to Tom. There are 208 zip codes in a 20-mile radius of Philadelphia, and I told him that we wouldn't stop sampling until we'd achieved our quota in each of those zip codes. And we have succeeded, as of last night, in exceeding our quota, in making or exceeding our quota in 174 of those zip codes. And we're only behind by a few responses in all the others. And then we sent survey crews on the ground into the neighborhoods where we knew we would not get online response, both the high end and the low end of the socioeconomic spectrum. And so we had a fantastic cooperation from the public library system. We had survey crews in public libraries all over, and farmers markets. And our last-ditch effort in the affluent areas was to put surveys in mailboxes. So we've really been kind of relentless in pursuing our quotas. And fortunately, we have a data set of 2,900 that just literally came out of the field last week. And so this whole notion of indexes, you know, I protested Tom's directive to say that we want one index to characterize all of cultural engagement. I'm like, it's too complex. And he said, no, I need it for public relations purposes. And I said, okay, so in November, we're going to have a meeting over a bottle of wine, and we're actually going to arm wrestle what goes into the index. But the subcomponents, and just to give you a sense where we're going to go, in addition to our survey, they have the data collection process that they actually have attendance figures from arts groups for years, and we're going to use that data instead of asking people, did you go to certain, you know, and get those figures. Some great indicators around public media, library use, some schools, arts. We're not exactly sure yet quite what we're going to get, but just to give you a flavor of where we're going to get indicators. Similar but different to the Irvine study, indicators we're covering music, dance, theater, reading, writing, visual art. And in Philadelphia, we're also adding a module for science, nature, and heritage. And a separate category, just like four questions about your online cultural activities. We're adding to that and a few general things. We're throwing in some civic indicators so we can correlate cultural engagement with civic engagement. At the end of the day, this is just a snap of what the survey looks like. And this is the theater and drama module. But again, we wanted to give in each category something that everyone could answer yes to. And then kind of move all the way down to the inventive form in this case, taking acting lessons. All right, and you can see, and then the real challenge with these studies is, you know, whether you ask about frequency or salience, right? How often do you do it? You know, and I don't know about you guys, but I can't remember what I did last week, much less a year ago, or how frequent I do things. It's really problematic data. So you kind of go for a semantic frequency cohorts, which is what we did, you know, almost never, never, almost never, and so forth. And then that on the far right, which of these activities are really important to you? You know, because you may not do them very often, but they might be really important to you. So we wanted to get that too. So we're going to wrap that, roll those all up, score them, create indexes for each of the areas, and this is sort of our placeholder calculation for what this engagement index is going to look like. And if you, any of you, would like to participate in the focus group that finalizes this, you're cordially invited to contribute. It's ultimately arbitrary, but at some point we have to make a decision of what constitutes cultural engagement. And so it's going to be a very interesting discussion. And maybe two bottles of wine, Tom. So with that, I close. And I just want to say that I am so inspired by the work of other researchers who allow me to build on their work. And my work is so symbiotic from project to project, and Tom's project would not have been possible without John's project, and John's project would not have been possible without 6 or 10 other studies that preceded it. And all of this is open and available to you in your communities. Although Wolf Brown owns these protocols, you are cordially invited to use them and adapt them and run with it, because we have to learn together how to measure cultural vitality in a way that advances our whole field. So thank you so much. Enjoy lunch.
Marching orders. I believe there's box. Let me tell you that. Here's my thought about the rest of the day today and maybe some revision for tomorrow. We have about maybe 20 minutes or so for questions with Alan, and then we'll go straight into the Richard Evans presentation and have a break after that, and then finish the day with Maria Jackson and presentation and conversation with Joan and Amy. Tomorrow we will be meeting at the hotel. I don't know the room, but I'm sure it's on somebody's schedule, and we'll find somebody who'll tell us. So we don't have to worry about travel tomorrow. I would like to preliminarily propose a change in the agenda for tomorrow that I'd like you to give some thought to. We can decide about it later, which is to, rather than have a whole session in the morning with a research roundup, open tomorrow with Bob Lynch talking about research into policy action, which I think, and specifically related to the presidential campaign, which I think everybody really wants to hear about, and to have questions and answers about that. And then to go into, given the size of this group, go into some breakout sessions for a while where we can really dig into some of the questions that have already come up and will come up through the rest of the afternoon, into, you know, in smaller groups where we can really have more interactive discussion about them, and then have a final session in which there'll be some kind of report out and thinking about what needs to happen next. And I'll work on the structure of that, but I wanted to put that in your mind and have you think about if there are, you know, key questions that you think we need to be discussing in smaller groups tomorrow, just at some point before the end of the day, just write them down for me and give them to me. And now, we need to stop promptly at 5, so I will continue traffic copying during the rest of the day. We have to be out of here at 5. And Lisa was going to say something, but she looks like, there she is. Okay, she's going to give us some information about where we are, the Carter Center, and some other matters. Thanks.
I didn't prepare anything, and I'll be brief because we have so much to talk about. But first of all, welcome to Atlanta. It's great to have you all here. We are here at the Carter Center and Library. The Carter Center is a couple of things. It is a museum, which is the federal division of this complex, which hosts traveling exhibitions, humanities-based, et cetera, kinds of traveling exhibitions. The Carter Center papers, the President Carter's library. And this is also home to President and Rosalind Carter, who are here about 1 week a month, scheduled in 5-minute increments. So it's a wonderful, it is a strategic alliance with Emory University, which is about a mile and a half away, and is a place where a lot of interesting things go on, and President and Rosalind Carter do actually do several forums and conversations here at the Carter Center that are open to the public, and it's quite a, become a wonderful center for discourse on key issues to the Carter, to President Carter and the community. We're on an important historic site, as you may have noticed. We're on a hill. This was a major Civil War strategic location because of the great view of downtown Atlanta. So that's where you are, just a brief moment. The other thing I wanted to do is to mention, just to clarify scheduling for tomorrow. We will end at a certain point in time, noon, and there are two short-length pre-conferences that go from 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock. And if you're interested, I encourage you to check them out. We're going to be finding out, Melinda's checking right now with Tomer Peterson, how much space might be available in them. One is a walk up historic Auburn Avenue. It's goes from 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock. It includes a few art pieces, a performance piece in the middle that is around the 1906 race riots that were here, and it ends at a water tower, which has a new installation in it, a video piece. And the other is a tour of the Beltline. What you'll see if you're out and about here at all is this is historically a city of railroads. This is why we are not Birmingham, this is a logistics city, and railroads are key to why Atlanta is such a thriving place. So what the Beltline is in very brief terms, been called the largest prospective urban development in America, and it is a network of abandoned rail lines that go through 18 different neighborhoods in Atlanta. It's as diverse as it could possibly be, and the tour tomorrow goes along portions of it. It'll be on combo bus and feet, and there also will be some brave souls who can get on a bike and do it. And the person who designed and articulated the vision for the Beltline will be with us. So he's a very smart, interesting person who did this as a part of his master's thesis as a student at Georgia Tech. So those are two really nice, and it's supposed to be a nice day. So I don't know who you should let know if you want to do this. I guess let Melinda, who's with us today, she's probably out there on the phone or whatever. I know we can accommodate a few more people in these and maybe even more than that. So they're great opportunities.
I just have one more thing. We've already gotten requests for Alan's PowerPoint and Bill's speech. And I've asked Alan, Bill, and also Richard if they would be willing to make their material available to be posted on the GIA website. And they said yes. So now I just have to get GIA to say yes, they'll do it. Right. So don't worry about frantically taking notes if it's just getting too crazy. And now I promise I'll give you enough time to answer all the questions. And who wants to go first? And, oh, yes, I should have asked this before. Could you all identify yourselves? This is being taped. And since we didn't get to introduce ourselves at the beginning because we were short of time, we don't all know, so aha.
Thank you. My name is Kong Huang. I'm with the Lindy Family Foundation. We're based in Boston, primarily within this field, funders of arts education. I guess I wanted to maybe get your reaction based upon your research to kind of what was posited this morning about, that arts and culture are kind of a merit-based good with sort of the thin norms as a theory. And my thought is that it's probably thinner because we think of arts and culture as organizations and institutions, and many of the your research talked more about it as activities that may exist outside of institutions. And just thinking a little bit more about that, of maybe the norms aren't as thin as we think, but they're thinner when we think about where we have levers to impact the arts and culture world, and what are those other, the next step might be thinking about how we might have different types of levers or different types of organizations that are not 501c3s to support.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, all of you, I hope, are researchers on your own behalf. And whenever you're stuck in an elevator or a taxi with someone, just ask them, how do you express yourself creatively? It's my favorite thing to do. The best interview I've ever had was with a taxi driver in New York City, and we had to pull over because we were both crying. If you just ask people, and I use the word creative instead of cultural or arts because it sidesteps a lot of the baggage, you begin to see how creative expression is fundamental to human identity and indistinguishable from humanity. And to acculturate is the most basic human instinct and survival. Actually, it's how people survive. So I don't, my conception of culture is informed by a few decades of interviews with people about how meaningful different forms of creative expression are. And who are we to make value judgments about which forms of expression are valid and which aren't? You know, I knocked on a door in Riverside when we were training our survey crews for the Irvine study. And initially, a young boy answered the door, and it was no English. And so he went and got his 14-year-old sister, and she went and then translated and got mom, who was a beautiful woman of Mexican descent, about maybe 55, 60 years old, and she invited us in and sat and offered us, and just after I told the survey crews, never go into anyone's home, and offered us water and, you know, very, very modest home. And at the end of our interview, one of our questions is, of all the art or decorations in your home, which one is most meaningful to you? And she thought a long time, and she said, it's the painting over my dining room table. And I asked her, may I look? She said, yes. So I got up and I looked around the corner, and there was a poster graphic of a photograph of a, just like a fruit tableau in a little plastic frame. And she went on and on about how this was meaningful to her. And boy, does it have a way of, is that humbling? A lot of preconceptions about what is meaningful to people go flying out the window when you hear that sort of thing, and it really recalibrates my own sense of what's meaningful and why, or what are we trying to do but create meaning. And if we can create meaning by helping people get a framed poster for $5 that they see day after day, you know, you begin to see that other part of the system that we're not really dealing with. So that's a long-winded way. I think that it is not at all, I mean, we talk about it as a, you know, as an optional cultural good, but it is so fundamental to human identity. Every community is profoundly creative and has the potential to be creative in ways they don't even understand yet. And, you know, I get calls, you know, we don't have much culture in our community, you know, I hear that, or, you know, we really don't, you know, how can we make our community a more creative place? Well, that's the wrong question, because your community is a highly creative place, you're just not seeing it or fertilizing it, you know, as you might. So symbolic representations of creativity in the community, I think, are really important, like participatory public art and stuff like that, that just says to a community, we are creative. and people begin to acknowledge and embrace and support creativity.
I think that's a good topic for a breakout tomorrow myself, how funders can intersect with that. Yes, Aaron, and then.
Aaron Trapp, Denver Office of Cultural Affairs. I want to ask a question about your creative capital study and what you shared with us from that.
Uh-huh.
And ask you what you expect to be the benefit of the creative capital conversation that's different from the intrinsic value. You know, in other words, is this going to be something that will further the case for the arts as a public good? Because as I understood it, creative capital is something that we spend collectively, in your views, in some way, as opposed to the Bourdieu-like definition of social capital, which is something that individuals leverage in their lives. So I'm struggling a little to understand where creative capital intersects with the arts as a public good. Mm-hmm. Are we trying to just measure people going to individual opportunities, or is this something then that we leverage together? And does that speak to does the creative capital conversation speak to that?
Well, I think what we're trying to say is that an outcome of cultural engagement is increased creative capital at the individual and family level and community level. So the outcome of cultural engagement is not just buying tickets. It's something more. You know, and what is that? And how can we measure it? So it's an outcome rubric that one can talk about. One could assess a community's creative capital, but that's a very complex equation. But it's simpler to approach it as an individual's creative capital. I mean, I could even see businesses assessing the creative capital of their employees and trying to raise it. I think I understand your question better now. Yes, I see it as an inherent intrinsic benefit. It's a positive social good. That is an outcome of engagement in the arts.
Lawrence Thuth, San Jose Office of Cultural Affairs. Alan, do you have a sense in the work that you've done for Irvine in the Central Valley and Inland Empire, if the findings there and what they tell you and us about this particular set of diverse communities, it can be overlaid onto other diverse communities, or is what's important for those of us who are not immediately concerned with the Central Valley and the Inland Empire, is it about the protocols? Is it just the awareness that study indicates a very different character to cultural participation than perhaps the assumptions that we've built our models on are?
It was geographically specific, but it was a huge area with some urban, you know, a lot of respondents were from Fresno and Riverside, which are cities. So if we administer the same protocol in Los Angeles, I can't say whether or not the results would be the same or not. But I can tell you that a lot of the themes are very consistent with other research. The prevalence of the home as a setting, the emergence of participatory forms of engagement, or at least more attention. So I can't really say, you know, the geographical, it reminds me every time I get a call from someone in Canada, they always say, oh, it's so different here. And I'm like, yeah. oh, really? Is it? You know, is it something in the water? You know, well, of course it's different in some respects, but in other respects, you know, it's the same. We're part of the same organism, cultural organism, that doesn't pay any attention to political boundaries. So it's really dicey. I can't say that someone who works in an urban area should take this as, you know, as the same results they would find if they did it. But on the same token, I think there are some, they just need to look at it for what it is and think about it.
Jermaine Williams from the Pittsburgh Foundation. I had a question about the creative capital study that you were doing. In the literature on social capital, there are two types of social capital. Mm-hmm. One is bridging, and then the other one is bonding. Uh-huh. And the bonding social capital is really kind of reinforcing notions of identity and kind of inward looking, while bridging social capital is willing to take risk with others who are very different from you. And I'm wondering, when you look at this high rate of kind of heritage-based mm-hmm. kind of creative mm-hmm. capital, mm-hmm. are you concerned that it's really not outward looking and risk-taking in terms of going into other communities or experiencing uh-huh. creativity from other cultures?
Yeah.
And is there a way to measure uh-huh. that kind of bridging social capital?
Yeah. Actually, we actually asked a pair of questions that directly address your question in the study. It was a pair of agree-disagree statements. One is, I seek out the art of cultures other than my own. And the other was, I'm primarily interested in the art of my ancestors or cultural group. And I call those two in culture versus cross culture, right? And actually, they're both a social good, right? And it's, there are some patterns about, you know, and 75% of everyone agreed on some level that they seek out other cultures. I think it was the Mexican farm worker sample that was the lowest of all the samples. So on some level, there's a lot of interest in other cultures, but it's the most natural basic human instinct to acculturate and to be a part of one's own culture. And this is the point about cultural relevance that I think a lot of arts groups don't get. You know, could you help me? You know, I get calls, you know, from orchids. Could you help me bring more young people to old people's programs? Or could you help me attract more black people to white people's programs? You know, essentially, that there's just a fundamental misunderstanding that people generally go to programs that are consonant with their self-concept. And it's the most natural thing in the world. And it is really only at the higher levels of education where people are interested in cultures other than their own. And that is regardless of race. So anyway, I don't know.
Bill Ivey from the Curb Center at Vanderbilt. In Arts Inc. and in my talk, I use the phrase expressive life, which has some similarities to creative capital. But what I try to talk about is a balance, almost an equal balance, between heritage on one side, which is about being connected and grounded and sort of historical, and voice, which is who I am as an individual. And I'm just wondering if you would take a minute to comment on how you feel that idea of an almost yin-yang balance between heritage and voice fits with the way you think about creative capital.
I almost understand your question. Do you maybe rephrase it?
Sure. Okay. Yeah, let me say it backwards. No, I use the phrase expressive life,
right,
and claim it as a public good, uh-huh. and I argue that it has two parts, the heritage part, which is close to the bonding notion of cultural capital or uh-huh. of community, and that it is sort of counterbalanced by individual voice. You know, if you listen to someone like Anthony Appiah, who writes very critically about the pull of tradition, saying that everyone should be cosmopolitan, that the challenge in the global society is for people to get away from heritage, to move out and be citizens of the world, and so on. Uh-huh. I think it epitomizes that tension, which is, you know, there's an element of grounding in art, and there's an element of breaking loose.
Yes.
And I sensed when in your formulation of creative capital, heritage was almost a subset. It was just sort of there. In your research, it looms rather large, and I was just wondering how you feel about that balance, and is that a balance that's important to you? That is, someone is both an individual free of their community and tied to it.
Right. Yeah. I think in the creative capital, I didn't show you the detail, but we do ask about what you would call heritage, about actually participation in collective rituals. Which is so powerful. You know, my favorite example was when the Boston Lyric Opera presented Carmen on the Common. You know, and they thought that 10 or 20,000 people would show up each night, and 50,000 people showed up the first night, 60,000 people. Those are low numbers. They were actually higher. And I was there surveying the audience, and, you know, our joke was that the blue hairs were actually the young kids with dyed blue hair. And it was young and vibrant, and I had that shock of realization that there's nothing sick about the art form. So, Bill, I do see this as a not so much a conundrum, but yin or yang. Both a healthy ecology has both. And I don't think we necessarily realize that as clearly as we could, particularly in conceiving community cultural rituals that are so powerful. I'm a huge fan of Carnival in Rio de Janeiro. I go whenever I can, and it's just the most unbelievable collective act of creative expression on the planet. And now you're starting to see these lighting festivals in cities. I think Boston just had one, and, you know, where people come out and just look at lights together. And you're starting to see, it's almost by chance, these collective rituals of creative expression, which tell people we are creative, you know, and it acts at a profound level on the public consciousness. And I think it's a critical part of the cultural system. And it also, you know, in a theater, when 1,000 or 2,000 people have a shared experience and everyone in the audience gasps at the same time, you know, there is something happening there on a collective level that is crucial to, I think, quality of life. And on the other hand, that individual expression is equally important. I couldn't possibly say one is more important than the other. So I fully embrace your theory, Bill.
I'm going to give Maria the last word for this session, but I just want to first say something. It sounded like what you were actually talking about was some form of communal cultural heritage being created on the fly, which is, I think, a little different from what Bill was talking about, but just raises a really interesting image for me, actually. So this is Maria Jackson, and I'm going to give her the last question before we break and move on to Richard.
So Maria Jackson, Urban Institute. And Alan, first of all, thank you for doing this work, because this is a huge step, I think, towards something that really needs to be pushed on, and that's the better thinking about participation and moving beyond just the audience paradigm and really understanding what the cultural sector, and broadly defined, has to offer in its fullness. But that said, a question for you about what you think or suspect are going to be the uses of the findings from this study at the local level. And specifically in Riverside, I understand this actually from a student of mine that's working in Riverside, the city is apparently adopting as its city moniker, Riverside, the City for Arts and Culture. And this is coming out of the Mayor and Economic Development Department. And it's, from what I've heard, it's largely tied to wanting to do something with the housing stock that's there and all of the foreclosures and attract people with means to the central part of the city, into the historic aspect of Riverside. So there's definitely an interest from the economic development and mayoral side, from what I understand. But I'm curious about this wealth of cultural expression and information that you're finding and how it can or could integrate with some kind of an agenda that might be afoot already.
That's a really good question. We are just now planning dissemination, and John can sort of speak to that in more detail. But we had always hoped to be able to communicate with city leaders on some level to try to connect this body of work with their larger community development planning work. And I don't know quite how that will go, because all of the research sort of points to, if you want cultural vitality, you then have to start caring about things that you haven't been caring about. And it's a whole new way of thinking, I think, for city leaders. But increasingly, I see they are hitching their trailers to the cultural vitality agenda, which ultimately empowers us, ostensibly, as purveyors of cultural vitality. And, if I go to another creativity conference where the arts people just stand there with their hands out to saying businesses, just send more money and buy more tickets, you know, we have to get past that and actually think about what we can offer as assets to city leaders and businesses in a whole new way. So it's a big question, and Marie, I know you struggle with this all the time, but how does our field learn? How do these ideas seep into the consciousness of practitioners? I wish I knew, but I think a lot of it is actually vocabulary, starting to talk about inventive and, interpretive, curatorial, observational, and start talking about heritage-based engagement. And that's kind of half the battle. And then actually having people from our sector grab a hold of some of these ideas and actually start to operationalize them. Because our field is one of where imitation is how things happen. So there's a lot of benchmarking going on, and as soon as a couple of groups are successful with some new approach, then others will follow. So anyway, and thank you so much for your great work.
Thanks, Alan. Thank you for a great part two of the presentation. I'm sorry we don't have more time for questions for this. I have a feeling that How Does Our Field Learn is a possible good segue to our next session, which I'd like us to go right into. Take a personal break if you need to, but we need to move on because we're slipping behind again. Thank you, Alan.